The views and opinions expressed by the guests on the following program do not necessarily represent those of Mark Radio, The Shepherd, or its advertisers.
From the studios of the Shepherd Radio Network, it's Afternoons with Mike. This next hour is all about our walk with Jesus, with local pastors, newsmakers, people who are making a difference for the gospel. Now, here is your host, Mike Gilland.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the program today, Afternoons with Mike, here on The Shepherd, sitting with a doctor today. The doctor is in the house, my friends, and I'm talking about Dr. Paul Schuler from the Ocoee area. Dr. Schuler is a very fascinating individual already. I can tell you that because he has a degree in electrical engineering before he went to get all of the degrees that you did in medicine. And so I feel like I'm talking to the mother load of brain power here. Welcome to my program.
I got to get that for my kids to listen to.
Yeah. That's right. You can tell them that the guy said that you had the mother load of brain power. That'll go. Yeah. Really, I'm excited to meet you. And welcome to my show.
Well, thank you for having me.
You know, so many times I think a lot of people would have general opinions about doctors. They have the oath that they took to serve and to basically be a doctor. It's really another step to find one who has faith in the Lord and who is a part of a church. And that's what you are.
Yes, I think it's integral to what I do and why. I guess the why is probably really the biggest issue for most people is why do you do what you do? And I think sometimes people struggle with that no matter what field they're in.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background? I know you mentioned that your mom and dad are still married and having been married for 60 some odd years.
Yeah, I can remember they did us all a favor as their kids because they put their year they got married in their email address. So I know they got married in 59 because it's there. So I can't ever, you know, if I ever forget it, I can double check.
Yeah, just by checking your contact list.
Exactly. But no, as we talked about before, and I don't know when at what point you've got audio for your audience, but you know, my parents are still alive. They're 85 and 88. And, you know, I'm a product of my parents' upbringing and, you know, I'm originally from a small town in Wisconsin. So I have that kind of, you know, for people that are from small towns in various parts of the country, they probably has meaning to them. And most people probably has some meaning to them, but that, you know, you kind of typically know your neighbors and mm-hmm. know something about everybody around. And I think that there's an accountability that comes with that and, you know, a vision beyond, you know, just oneself that you can pick up as part of that.
Also part of that would be kind of like the mindset of America in that time frame. And that's getting a little on the rare side too. In a lot of parts of our country where there's that you mentioned, you called it accountability. And I think that's a really wonderful expression to use to try to describe the kind of the sense of community where they really watch out for one another.
Well, watch out and, you know who people are like,
yeah.
As a, you know, which meant, you know, in some ways as a kid growing up, you know, you know, I couldn't probably do anything and really get away with it because anybody in town would say, hey, we were fortunate in a sense too, that, you know, my aunt and uncle lived in the same little town. And so I had cousins and whatever. So if people didn't know who my parents were, they knew what family I belonged to. So, you know, it's two sides, right? It's that in a positive sense, it's like, you know, the community sort of, there was communication there, positive or otherwise. It's like, hey, your kid was doing this, whether it's good. Hey, I saw your kid did great, you know, or won this award, or, you know, what happened, or they're in the hospital. What do you need? It was that sort of, you know, it was almost like extended family in a sense.
Yeah.
And whether that existed in the rest of the world or the rest of the country, you know, really, I in some ways, I don't even know because I was, you know, that's where I was and that's what I knew.
That was your world.
Yeah. I didn't grow up in New York City or anywhere else. I mean, I remember growing up and, even working for a guy on a farm, and his kids. And I remember thinking, you know, to his kids, there was their Kmart, you know, there was, the, yeah. It was, hey, this is the, or Kmart was like a single store, not a chain, it wasn't like a, you know, there was McDonald's was that one restaurant in the, you know, in the big town over the one of them. It wasn't, you didn't have that perspective. Like, well, this is a franchise and there's 10,000 of them across the country. And you don't have any of that perspective. It's that place you can go to get an ice cream cone on, you know, Saturday afternoon, cheap, you know, with the parents, that kind of thing.
Did you go to church with your parents?
I did. Yeah. My parents, when I was young, attended a Lutheran church, which was out in the country. And that's where I started going to church. And that's where, you know, when I was, I remember, you know, in the classroom in the basement, not necessarily, I believe, having a full concept of what the Sunday school teachers were trying, you know, were truly, you know, I guess I don't think I didn't know 100%, but mm-hmm. I knew, you know, they were teaching me about Jesus and about salvation. And, you know, that's when I remember, I mean, I remember the room, I remember the little chairs and table and everything there. And it said, well, you know, this is something I want to do. I need to do this. I need to put my faith in this guy. And, you know, it was God's son. I think it is kind of on a Sunday school story level of understanding, if I can use that,
mm-hmm.
you know, was, you know, like the picture, maybe picture book kind of level of understanding, like you may have when you're 6 years old. But that's the day and time I can, you know, specifically remember, you know, at first saying, this is, you know, I'm making this decision for myself. So
as you grew up, were there times where maybe some of that was questioned in your life?
There absolutely were. And there were times that, you know, like going through high school where, you know, I was part of I would say it's a like Campus Crusade. We did, mm-hmm. you know, we did some of that and, Youth for Christ when I was in high school, we did, you know, I was part of that, but at the same time there were times when I was still trying to sort out for myself. And then you see people that, honestly, there's the ideal, like as a Christian, you're supposed to, you know, your model's not supposed to be another person in your sphere of, or it's supposed to be, you know, Christ who died on the cross. But practically speaking, I think, at least for me, and I believe this is true of many people, you know, you find people that you know and you see on earth and kind of observe them. And there's good and bad that comes out of that, because, you know, I've yet to become aware of anybody who really is not a fallen human being. And so, you know, it's, you know, we're not, you know,
category.
You go, well, they're not perfect, or, you know, you know, and it's especially at that time and trying to solidify my own, you know, the faith and the challenges. And sometimes, you know, people would, you know, they kind of make fun of you and say, well, what are you doing? Or, you know, when I was in high school, we'd get to, you know, we'd had, you know, the Youth for Christ group would get together, you know, on a weekday, you know, before school. And, you know, and it's, you know, you're become aware that you're different. You know what I mean? And
yes.
When you're in high school, being different is often uncomfortable, if I can say it that way, because
mm-hmm.
that's my recollection of it. It was uncomfortable and, you know, you get challenged, and it isn't like, oh, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to see the movies that other people are seeing, I listen to similar music and some of the same music as other people. So it was, you know, still being worked out, I guess, in my head at that point in time. And even, I mean, obviously I encounter different circumstances in my life now, but I still have to kind of work through that.
Now, you became an engineer first before you going into medicine again. Did you ever, as a young person back in this time when you were, let's say, high school age or whatever, that you thought of medicine as a career?
I did. I've been asked many times throughout my life, you know, so you went to engineering and then you went to medicine. How was that? And the reality is that, again, formative years, you know, I was born with a club foot. I saw my orthopedist more than I saw my pediatrician when I was a kid. Mm. I had an interest in medicine from making a difference in the world kind of perspective. But I also, you know, I come from a long line of people. I say I was born and bred to build and fix things, from my grandfather, who was an airplane mechanic in the First World War, all the way on. I mean, we're hands-on mm-hmm. doers, fixers, yeah. that kind of stuff.
And thus the engineering.
Yeah, yeah, right. I, you know, not to go that far back in history, but my grandfather was a guy without a degree who ended up running a manufacturing facility for General Motors. So, you know, because he could, you know, because he worked his way from the bottom all the way to the top. Mm-hmm. So that's that's the sort of background of people. I mean, you know, I have that, you know, from my dad, my uncle, people that, you know, my uncle was president of the American Dental Association and at the same city council and president. And my dad was on the school board and the State Board of Public Instruction, and people that invested and continue to invest themselves in others in the community at large mm-hmm. from the beginning. So I had that perspective, and yet coming from a small town, I said, you know, this is my little world, you know, but it's a huge commitment to go do that. And what I want to be sure of is that that's something that's really from me and not the product of my sort of idyllic view of the world, that once I get out there and I really have to own it for myself, I'm going to say that, well, that really wasn't me. That was my parents, my family, my, you know, heritage, things that in me, but it's really not coming from me mm-hmm. because I've seen people along the way in the course of life that they do things for those reasons and they are unhappy to miserable mm-hmm. or they lack drive or they end up lost. So that was sort of, you know, engineering. I'm again, small town Midwest guy. There's things I wanted to do. I wanted to be on my own. I wanted to stand on my own 2 feet. I wanted to own a house. That might seem crazy, but I wanted to own a house.
As a young man, that's,
you know,
really
I basically wanted to establish my own identity and figure out again that, and then make my decisions from there if that was really something I still wanted to do. So
why electrical engineering?
Why not? I mean, why electrical? Honestly, there again, this I would say would speak to the role of mentorship. In a sense. So in my high school, when I referenced that farm that I said I worked on, that farm actually was owned by a guy who, by the name of Lloyd Edge. Lloyd is passed on, but Lloyd was he was a vocational educational instructor in my high school. He taught, electrical, electronic stuff, among other things. You know, that was something I had an interest in. I had an opportunity. I took some of his classes. I did circuits and some of the other stuff in high school. Had a background in it. I mean, Lloyd hired me for the summer. He had a tenant farmer on his farms, but you know, basically in the summer as a teacher. I mean, he was a farm guy growing up. So we did all the maintenance, mm-hmm. all the repair, all the building, all the demolition. You know, I think he had 3 farms total. So it was. You know, so
plenty of work to do.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It was one of those things. It was, there was ample work to be done mm-hmm. from that. But, you know,
did you practice, in this field after you graduated or
electrical engineering?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I did my undergrad at Michigan Technological University. I got a scholarship from General Motors. And I worked for summers for them. When I graduated, they offered me a job and I worked in their advanced engineering staff for several years. Prior to going to medical school, I did all my pre-med stuff with my engineering during my undergrad.
You were putting that away just in case then.
Yeah, I had it. I did that. I took the MCAT, which is the entrance exam for medical school. So I knew kind of where I was if I wanted to do that.
What won the day for you to make the switch? What was the one thing that you would say pushed you over to make the decision?
What made that decision for me? You know, I, well, I, man, you know, one, like I said, I had a job, I bought a house, I was standing, you know, I had a chance to do some of that. I was working in that field. I was looking down the road some in that it's a typical question that people when they're interviewing for jobs, and I've told this to my kids and many other people, and in even interviewing, and even as you go through the career, one of the things people ask you is, where do you see yourself in 5 years or 10 years down the road? And, you know, as I got into that and I started looking down the road, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the road, I said, you know, I'm not sure, you know, I'm pretty sure that's not where I want to be. I saw the battles that people fought within the organization. Not, I mean, for me, you know, for what I thought was right. Believe it or not, in the business world, in our country, and probably every country, not every decision is based on what's right, and and what you know, some of it's based on self-promotion, and some of it's based on, you know, expediency.
And the almighty buck for a lot of people.
Well, right. I mean, right. But I saw, you know, I don't want to, I probably don't, you know, you get to see enough different things. I mean, I made good friends with the people who also shared that perspective, but I count myself as blessed in the time I was there. You know, while I was working there, I got married. I met my wife, who was she was a student at what one time was GMI, became Kettering University. So I met my wife, we got married. So she's been with me on this entire path of medical school and everything else, which I know, you know, there's other physicians and surgeons that I encounter, and, you know, their relationship with their spouse, you know, I think there's things about having gone through it all together. That's why I said, if I say we, it's really because it's not, it's a journey and it's an adventure.
You guys
and it's investment.
Are a team. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's more than a team in the, you know, in the sporting sense. It's a, you know, this is a joint endeavor and on so many levels that we couldn't get there otherwise. So, I probably lost focus on your question in that long
okay.
ramble. But
well, we're here at the end of the segment one anyway. But my guest today is Paul Schuler, Dr. Paul Schuler. And in a moment when we get back, we'll find out a little bit about what he is doing now and this great path from a young man up in the upper Midwest to living in Florida and serving as a doctor of orthopedics. We'll be back with him in a moment. Don't go away. This is Afternoons with Mike. It is a real joy to get to talk to Dr. Paul Schuler. He is from the Ocoee area, lives and works in the Windermere area of Orlando. And Dr. Schuler started off in college, as we've just heard, in electrical engineering, became an actual graduate of engineering, and worked for a couple of years, you said, as an engineer, in your heart, you look forward 5 years from now, 10 years from now, as many people do, asking themselves that question, where will I be? You saw yourself obviously doing something different than electrical engineering. And now that's causing you to go back into the direction of this thing that you had thought of during your schooling, and that was medicine. What kind of time commitment did it take schooling-wise, years-wise, from the moment that you made the decision to go into it?
Well, from when I really pulled the trigger, which, you know, if my wife were here, she would say, yeah, I was actually sending out applications for our medical school while we were on our honeymoon, which is, again, kind of speaks to the level of support required on her part. But medical school itself is 4 years, you know, post secondary education. So if you have a bachelor's degree, it's another 4 years of college. Basically, 2 years of that is largely classroom didactic. And the second half of that, which goes through the summer, so it's not like you get the summer off, it goes through the summer, is clinical rotation. So, you know, patient fronting experiences, you know, educational under the guidance of experienced staff. During that time, you have to, as a physician, you generally have to sort out what area of medicine you want to focus on, because in the world today, I don't know if there's anywhere in our country anyway where you can graduate from medical school and ultimately go into practice. Like 50 years ago, mm-hmm. it was a lot more like dentistry, where you could get done with the with that and you can go into practice. Whereas in medicine now, I think everywhere you have to do at least some level of postgraduate training, residency. In my case, orthopedic surgery, it was a year of what's called a rotating internship with various experiences, anesthesiology, critical care medicine.
So that would make it medicine. 5 years right there.
It's 5 years of residency training after 4 years of medical school. So it's 9 years of that. And I would say, you know, there's the other facet of that. I can tell you that during my residency, there was the beginning of a movement to limit resident work hours. I think they're now limited to 80 hours a week. We were not limited to 80 hours a week. I saw the very tip of that, and they had to change our whole work schedule, which was that they wanted you to have one 24-hour period off without clinical responsibility every week. Well, our program didn't have that built in. They had to reconfigure the training program there was still not an hour limit, but it was everybody was supposed to have one 24-hour period in a week where they couldn't mm-hmm. be called on or have responsibility. So to put that in context, you know, that means that we couldn't count on 24 hours of to be off ever during that 5 years. So,
how is it that anybody can survive that? I mean, that seems like that would be so fatiguing. And when you're talking about the kind of pressure that a doctor is under and the responsibilities that you have and the liability that you have, how is it that people are staying alert enough during that kind of a 5-year residency or doing these rotations? How do they do it?
Caffeine? I don't know. There reaches its limits. I mean, it is physically demanding, but you know, I think of guys in the military that get deployed, and I can't imagine that those guys that are out, I mean, you know, they're out in the field mm-hmm. for That's extended true. Periods of yeah. times. I mean, I can't, you know, I couldn't answer the question for them either. You know, when you're, you know, when you, if you're up 20 hours, you know, 20 hours day after day after day after day, you know, but at some point
you have to crash.
At some point you have to crash, but mm-hmm. you know, when I mean, you learn to function a different way. I think there's I honestly think that you function in a little bit different level that when, you know, when you get used to that and it, to a degree you're able to focus, you have an underlying fatigue that it's a little bit of what you become accustomed to, mm-hmm, right? Like, yeah. Like I'm not a runner, but I have friends and I know people that are runners. And, you know, they can run 10 miles and as easy as I can, you know, walk around the block. So I think there's an element of training and conditioning that goes into that, along with the fact that, you know, I don't think I could do it today. You know, 30 years later, I don't think I could do that physically. But there's, you know, there's a wonder about being in your 20s that, you know, you have a lot more strength and endurance mm-hmm. and stamina and, yep. I guess that's about all I can really say to that.
Youth is a marvelous thing.
It is. It is.
And that's so incredibly true. Now, when in this process of all of this schooling, you made a decision to go in a particular direction with sports medicine, orthopedics. What drew of interest all of that field for you?
Well, I mean, I'm an orthopedic surgeon. As I said, I think you got it in the first segment. I was born with a club foot. I had, you know, more time with my orthopedist than I did with my pediatrician. But the other part of that is that background I alluded to, which is, you know, some ways I can say, you know, my job is really, you know, I'm a maintenance guy in a lot of ways. You know, it's applied science. And so I have a lot of respect. I mean, there's areas of medicine that I like when I trained, I worked with guys that were pediatric. I can barely even talk about some of the stuff without it giving me goosebumps. Pediatric hematologist, oncologist, critical care, that, you know, they took care of kids with cancer. And I personally, I couldn't do that. I mean, it tears me up those realities. And I also have people that are internists, and I joke a lot with people, but you know, when you're dealing with people and their diabetes and their high blood pressure, and essentially you're telling people, do these things you don't want to do, eat these things you don't want to eat, don't do the things you want to do, don't eat the things you want to eat, and you'll be better off. And it's a large element of faith. You know, I would say that I'm a shallow individual. I need that recurring validation of, you know, I see people and they can't walk, and I take care of them and they can walk. And it's a privilege to be able to participate in that. Yeah, and I get to see that. Now, not everything always works out exactly the way everybody, you know, not everybody's perfect and in that regard, which, you know, still takes its toll, because you're invested in the outcome of people, and people will let you down too, which is why I think it's critical to get buy-in. But I got drawn into that for based on my personal experience. Based on, I think, the same personality that drew me to engineering, which is, you know, I'm trying to solve a tangible problem.
It's almost like you have the nuts and bolts job of medicine then.
Yeah. I mean, within medicine, you know, orthopedists are frequently referred to as carpenters, right? I mean, that, if you weren't aware of that, that's a common reference we get.
Well, you know, when, as I've told you, I went through a knee surgery first, where I had a knee replacement.
Yeah.
And I had a marvelous anesthesiologist that day who took me under, but I not completely, because I woke up right in the middle of the surgery. I just came to and I couldn't see anything. They had everything blocked off.
Oh, yeah.
But I could hear them hammering, and they're literally hammering a spike into my leg. And I said, "Hey, everybody, how you doing?"
Yeah.
And the guy, the anesthesiologist, he said, "Well, now, what are you doing awake?" And so we talked just for a moment. And I'm all this time, I can remember it to this moment. I'm hearing them hammering. I'd seen the video, so I knew what was going to happen. Yeah. I knew what he was doing. He was hammering that spike down in my bone. And he was all about the business. Well, they didn't take very long, and I was back under again.
Right.
But I mean, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. You're doing big kind construction carpentry work in areas that people just can't imagine.
Well, these days, as opposed to when I trained, like you just said, people, you know, people can, some people do, some people want a Sunday morning quarterback or whatever you call it. But yeah, you know, for me, it's that tangible, you know, that tangible difference that you get to make. You know, I've realized as I've gotten older that I picked up the storytelling thing a little bit, but from, honestly, my first year in practice, and I was in Wisconsin then, and I had this gentleman was probably in his mid 70s, his wife had broken her hip, and we were having this conversation before surgery about what the expectation, which was we're going to, you know, she was going to get a partial hip replacement that evening. And then the next day we were going to get her up out of bed, and she was going to get up and be walking on it. And he told me that to him, that was nigh unto a miracle, because as he put it, he said, "When I was a boy, I remember the neighbor across the road, you know, in the farm across the way, broke his hip. And the only thing they could do is basically put him in a wheelchair. And, you know, on nice days, they'd wheel him out on the porch and he'd get to be outside most of the day. And at the end of the day, they'd wheel him back in. But I swear he never got further from the house than the porch from the day he broke his hip. So the fact that my wife's going to be able to get up and walk again is a miracle."
Yes.
And you know, to me, that's a privilege to be able to be involved in that. I look at it that way. That's the goal, is to restore people's function.
There's two ways that I see that about you, Dr. Schuller. Number one, I see it in the emotion in your eyes and in your face when you're talking about children and knowing these doctors that are dealing with things like cancer, pediatric diseases that are horrible. And it takes grace. It takes a special type of grace, but it also takes a special type of grace and wisdom and training that you're able to restore mobility to people the way you're doing. And I can also tell that you enjoy getting to do that as well.
Well, it's satisfying. It's satisfying to be able to see the outcome of that. I mean, it's also satisfying. I mean, there are certainly times, I mean, a lot of what I do, there's many people I see that don't, I mean, they don't need surgery necessarily, or they don't necessarily want surgery, or they need to know, you know, a lot of it is decision making.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think many people in my field, you know, if you just took an X-ray like yours, you showed me, I could say, well, this is probably what you need to have, and this is what I'd expect to find, you know, and I could do that probably from, you know, I could do that in 10 seconds. I could say, this is probably what you need, but that, you know, that isn't, it isn't, we don't treat pictures. We don't treat bones. Mm-hmm. We treat people.
Yeah.
Exactly. And one of the things, I had a gentleman who was a pediatrician when I was a medical student, I remember, and he was a man of faith as well. And he said, I remember he told me as a medical student, he said, you know, one of the things, you know, you should never forget, you know, your patients need to know it, but you need to know it more than anybody else, is that as physicians, we treat people, but we don't heal people. You know, there's only one healer, and it's not us. And so, you know, that, you know, I mean, I appreciated him sharing his faith that way and that perspective. Right. And, you know, that really is, you know, that, you know, there's so much in the world that can, that's background noise, but with, you know, with what I get to do. And that was part of that transition from being in engineering, is there's always battles and there's always things. And at the end of the day, most of the time for me, you know, the things that I end up fighting battles for are things that are going to make a difference, you know, maybe not for the world as a whole, maybe not for the state, maybe not even for the community, but for at least for the person that I'm, you know, that one person that I'm working with. And that's, you know, that is really, you know, that's, it's easier to do,
mm-hmm.
Honestly, for me than for some of those other circumstances.
Now, you mentioned a while ago, like, it's incredibly satisfying. What would be to you one of the cases that you've worked on that might be maybe the most complete thing that said, yeah, that's why I'm in this. That's why I became a doctor. That's why I became an orthopedic surgeon. Is there a particular case?
You know, I don't know if I can name one as a whole, because it, you know, it's the, you know, I mean, the things I do are satisfying to me. I've, you know, I know that there are other people that are trained and skilled in the same areas, in the same fields. And so the challenge sometimes for people is to accept the fact that, you know, there's probably nothing that I'm doing for somebody that somebody else really couldn't do, at least from a, you know, from a like standpoint of, you had your knee replaced. I mean, mm-hmm. I do knee replacements. You had your knee replaced. It sounds like you've done very well. And that's the name of the game. That's what everybody wants. And so it's, you know, it's a challenging to, you know, it's challenging to say, oh, this is the one reason. It's as if I could do, but it's more about the people
mm-hmm.
themselves. You know, I've been in Central Florida about 8 years, and about 3 weeks ago in my office, I had three people come in on the same day that I had cared for probably within the first 6 months of being in Central Florida. And they all said, well, I don't know if you remember me, but, you know, you took care of me for this, and, you know, I have this problem and I wanted you to take care of me. And so, more so than one specific case, and I think I saw them back to back to back in the office. And it was, I said, I, you know, there's something to this. I don't know what it is, but, you know, it's validating that people, I think, that come back for that, because this in our country, in our community, people are blessed to have. I mean, there's a lot of very skilled people here in this community and in this country and, you know, in this state, you know, providing the orthopedic care. You know, so the fact that they, you know, people would come back, you know, to me specifically for that, I think it's because, you know, that's the part probably that's satisfying, that they trust me.
They do.
And that they, you know, I've had people say that, you know, as they don't feel like they're getting run through a mill, you know, like they're not just a number, or they're not just another knee, hip, shoulder, ankle, toe, whatever it is. And that's the part of where I, you know, I think that's come for me, honestly, with some time and maturity to say, you know, this is really, you know, a little bit more, you know, at the beginning, it was probably more about what made me feel good myself, And that it doesn't make me, but I understand that it's really that that's more my day-to-day perspective. I think at this point in my career is if I have to educate people so they can make a decision and know that it's okay not to do something right now, or that they can wait so that, that they're enabled to make the best decision for themselves. I mean, that's really, you know, that's really what we end up wanting to do.
Well, I appreciate you coming in today, Dr. Paul Schuler, surgeon and from the Ocoee area. God bless you. Thank you for taking the time and sharing this wonderful story. I trust that as people, as they've listened to this, they're going to be very encouraged to realize there are doctors and they can look you up too. If they're needing to see somebody, if they need the kind of services that I've been blessed with in my life, with a shoulder and a knee, they need to give Dr. Schuler a call. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
It's been great to hear your story. And we'll be back in a moment. Don't go away. This is Afternoons with Mike. I am back in the studio, and joining me now is Albert Mixner. Albert leads a company, Mixner & Company. It's a CPA firm. They specialize in contractor bonding, and that for a business, any business knows that at times you have to have the assurity that your finances are going to be there and you're going to be protected, and that's what they do. And they watch over these businesses. Albert, welcome to my program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's really great to have you here. And I love CPAs. I have a lot of great friends that are accountants, and that's something. I'm a math guy myself, so I've always liked crunching numbers, but you do it at a whole different level than what I ever knew and ever could do. Plus, I love the fact that you're a man of faith in business. And I love the fact that you have an opportunity to be a marketplace minister.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So do you find lots of opportunities along the week to share your faith or what God's done in your life?
I try to actively display my faith both verbally as well as whenever I write somebody an email or a letter. In fact, my final salutation on a letter is Maranatha.
Which, as you know, is
come Lord soon. And that's,
that's right.
I try to make it obvious without being obvious, if you will, just in my communication with everybody that they need to know that I'm a believer. And I try to make any opportunity if they have questions or want to make a comment, I'm ready to jump in and overload them.
Wouldn't it be great one day to be in heaven and find out all the people that were touched by that and maybe didn't know what Maranatha meant, and they looked it up and found out what it meant, and it caused them to start praying that way.
Exactly, exactly. In fact, I look forward to that day.
Yes. I think all of us are looking forward more than ever before to that day. And we say, Lord, come quickly. Yeah, absolutely. Albert, how did you come to know the Lord?
Well, in 1990, the pastor of the First Baptist Church of Winter Park came and did a visit on our home. And he was I used to like to call him the football player pastor, because he was very aggressive about making sure that he didn't leave until you either made a decision or you convinced him that you weren't going to make a decision. But that was, unfortunately, that was a head knowledge decision. It was not a heart decision. The heart decision didn't come until some years later when I was at the First Baptist Church in Orlando under Jim Henry, and I was going to an evangelism explosion class.
Mm-hmm. EE.
And in listening to Tim, and I won't say his last name, he's a godly Christian man, but he was talking about a situation that he had been involved with in making a visit. And he told me about the symbolism of visualizing inside of your heart, and there is a throne sitting there. And what you have to do when you make a decision for Christ is you have to get up from that throne and ask Christ to sit there. And that was an overwhelming visual event, if you will, for me. And I did, at that day, I made that heart decision and asked Christ to sit on my throne. And it wasn't until I did that things really began to change. The Word opened up to me. I had a hunger for the word that I couldn't get satiated. I was reading God's word every day, looking for source materials to continue to explore different avenues and so forth. And it was a wonderful event. I mean, it just made all the difference. And so that's, you know, now that I know more than I did back then, I understand that that's really the involvement of the Holy Spirit. And it makes a huge difference.
It really does. I had a friend one time that had a similar type of, it was almost for him like a dream that he had while he was waking up. And in this dream, he saw the throne, just like what you're talking about, in his, and he could see that someone was sitting there, and he's thinking that it was the Lord. And then as the camera in his dream unfolded and was moving upward, suddenly he realized that he was the one on that throne.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And that's a very real, and for him, it was a chilling revelation that the Lord had shown him that he was really the one on the throne, not the Lord.
Yeah.
And we can be mistaken at times as to the effectiveness of our faith if we are only giving, like you said, head knowledge and not heart knowledge, heart assent to God.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I was not raised in a Christian home, and we did attend church every now and then, but there was no talk about Jesus and a relationship with Christ and making a commitment and decision and so forth. And so I just didn't know, you know, I was just ignorant.
Well, thank God you found out. Thank God for that class. Thank God for Tim.
Absolutely.
And you know, when you look back on our life and we think we have those pivotal moments, those demarcation marks in our lives where everything changed, and it really did bring about an everything change in your life.
Yes, it did.
And then you've also had some battles in your life along the way.
Yes, I have. 23 years ago, I found out that I had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It was schedule B, and it was stage 4. I had a tumor inside my left femur and a tumor wrapped around my spine at L4 and L5. And they immediately put me in the hospital, put a chemo port in, and started chemotherapy. The chemotherapy I did was, they refer to as CHOP. And the CHOP each refers to a different kind of chemical that they give you. And I can't pronounce them.
Brutal.
Yeah, I can't pronounce them all. The H stands for the one that they call the red devil, and that's the one that causes the pain and you lose your hair and so forth. And so I had 6 chemo treatments at 3-week intervals. And then as soon as I was finished with that, it was followed up by 18 radiations in both locations.
Now, with that kind of a tumor and that kind of a diagnosis, surgery wasn't part of your treatment then?
Wasn't an option. No, it had to be chemotherapy and radiation was all that was available. And so that was like, it started in June of 01, and then I finished it in January of 02. I finished the radiation. Yeah. And then so they claimed that I was cured. And I got back to my life and my routines, which is, by the way, is what you lose when you get sick. You lose your routines, going to work, you know, just the normal things that you do. And that's the first thing you miss. It isn't being sick. It's losing the routines. And of course, I was self-employed. And so that was kind of my fiefdom, if you will. And I couldn't go to my fiefdom because of the cancer and the treatment and so forth. 2 years ago, it came back. So the prediction of the doctor to say that it was cured wasn't quite totally true. And this time the cancer was the same kind of cancer, but it was in my blood. And so, once again, we immediately went in the hospital, had another chemo port put in, and started a chemo protocol called B-R. And those were given every 30 days, and I had 2 of those treatments, and then COVID hit. And my doctor said, we don't want to drive you down, you know, have your immune system really weak and then catch COVID and die from that, so we're going to stop.
So they deemed that the presence and the non-treatment of the cancer would be better to let it sit than to risk you lowering your immune system and getting COVID.
Exactly, exactly. It was kind of like a triage situation. It was the lesser of two evils, if you will. But in the meantime, we continued to do CAT scans and MRIs and so forth, and to watch the cancer progress. And it's during a 6-month period, the cancer disappeared. And the doctor couldn't believe it. Now, obviously, I was praying all along during that time asking God to bring healing into my life and to drive this cancer out.
That's typically 2 treatments from chemo would not cure the cancer.
No, he was going to do 8.
Yeah.
That was his expectation. But so anyway, so yeah, God had put his hand in my life and the cancer disappeared and the doctor was astounded. And I remember saying to him, are you telling me that I'm done with, he says, yeah, you're done. We'll go get your chemo poured out.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously I was relieved and happy and unburdened and just,
yeah.
It was amazing. So, so that was a great day.
Yeah, that's a wonderful day. And you know what, when you think back about the people that you might've seen when you were in those early on treatments, all that work and all of that, and you, I'm sure you went through the whole hair loss thing as well. What would be your thoughts about people today when you see or hear that somebody is fighting that? What happens in your mind?
Well, it's scary. Even though I was a believer, it's, you know, you're afraid of the unknown. You don't know how or what's going to happen. Obviously, if you're going to pass, you know you're going to go be with the Lord, and so you hang on to that. But there's a lot of steps in between now and that particular day,
mm-hmm.
and so that creates a lot of insecurities in your mind. But if I was going to talk to anybody who had cancer, I would say, don't give up. The medicines today, they've made great strides in improving the treatments and the chemo protocols and so forth. And now they're at the point where they just would give you a pill to get rid of the cancer. I mean, you don't even have to go through what I did 23 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it's beatable. And it's not going to be any fun, but you're going to beat it, and you're going to, more than likely, you're going to come out the other side. Now, that's not true with every form of cancer. Some mm-hmm. of them are just really nasty.
Yeah, some of them, it's almost like a freight train, and you can't stop it. I mean, it's going
right.
to go through, and
that's
it's going
right.
to do its damage.
That's right.
And it does it quickly.
It does, and the key to that is finding it early, and that was my case the first time. They
mm-hmm.
found it early. And it was an accident. I mean, I had a back pain. I went to the chiropractor. He adjusted me. The next day, it was worse. I went to my doctor and told him that I was in excruciating pain. We went and had a CAT scan. He saw the tumor. Boom, checked me in.
Yeah,
so
right.
It was accidental that we even found it early, but that's the key.
Mm. As a businessman and the time that we have remaining, Albert, what encouragement, what advice do you give people who are maybe sitting on the edge of walking in faith and letting the faith affect and impact them in their business, as opposed to what I sense you're doing and you're looking for every opportunity to share your faith? What advice do you have?
Stay in God's Word. I love the Word of God, and I can't get enough of it. And it feeds me more than I feed it, if you will. That's kind of a silly comment, but it just, every time I read it, I find something new, and God speaks to me through His Word.
Mm.
And I've heard people say that, you know, well, God spoke to me, and, you know, I always looked at that with a jaundiced eye, but that's how He's doing it. He's talking to you through His Word, and He really does do it. And you can't spend enough time in God's Word. In fact, God's Word says that. I mean,
right.
Paul says that, you know, pray unceasing. Read the Word unceasing. I mean, it's just the kind of thing where regardless of what's going on in your life, whether it's a medical condition or whether you're in business and maybe it's faltering or whatever, put yourself in God's Word, put the problem in His hands, and He will solve it every time. He's faithful.
That's a good word. How can people get in touch with you if they're hearing, hey, this is a CPA that I'd like to get involved with my business? How can they get in touch with you?
Well, there's a website, mixnerco.com. That's probably the cleanest way to reach out to me. Of course, my cell phone is 321-229-9257. We take phone calls or inquiries anytime.
That was mixnerco.com.
That's correct.
And, boy, it's really wonderful again to talk to somebody like yourself. a man who is in business, a man who is of faith, and he puts those together in an unapologetic way. And that just stands to me as a model, and I want to say thank you.
Well, thank you very much for having me today.
Well, it's been our joy. And friends, we thank you for being with us as well here on The Shepherd. We'll catch you next time on Afternoons with Mike.